All right, Ryan, thank you. Well, this is just a time of dialogue, Q&A. We don't have to go very long. If we can just go just a little while, have some dialogue, then we can get out early and enjoy some tea or something. So this is your time, whatever you want to talk about. Any questions? And I'll try to remember to repeat the questions for the taping as well. You came to a Q&A and you have no questions. This is really good. Yes, sir. Basically, you're giving a scenario, but you're saying, what about a man who has been divorced and being in the ministry? Is that right or wrong? Is that the question? Absolutely wrong. And the reason is, he has to be above reproach. I don't know how a man could be above reproach with a divorce. God hates divorce. I mean, this isn't just a lightweight sin in the mind of God. Now, if he was the, perhaps the, I was going to say the victim, but I'm not sure there really is a victim in divorce. It takes usually two people, and there's usually one person more wrong than the other. But if he were to ever be in ministry again, I think it would be years or decades, not just a few months, that the Lord could show that the tower of his life could put that divorce in the shadows. So I would not think it would be wise, a la 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, that he wouldn't be above reproach. And a reproach means there's something you could ask questions about his life. So that's, I mean, I know that's the position of our pastor, John MacArthur. He would extend that not just to preaching pastor, but he extends that even to our elders, to becoming an elder. So, any follow-up? Okay, thank you. Adultery and abandonment, yes. Yeah, the question is, what about divorce with relation to adultery and the qualifying reason for adultery? Can Lance Quinn has said in his seminar that it need to be unrepentant adultery to qualify for a divorce. What if a person just did that one time? Well, I think that you need to ask the question, Sean, about the opposite of unrepentant, and that is repentant, and that is this. If a person had committed adultery multiple times over many years and, you know, tried to hide it and was found out and was sorry but not repentant, meaning they would abandon and confess, then that's clearly an opportunity to use the exception clause in Matthew for divorce. But ask the question the other way, and that is, what if a person blew it once, twice, I don't know, three, seven, I don't know what. What if they did that and were genuinely repentant and wanted the marriage to work out? Can you get a divorce? You could probably use a biblical argument that you could. Is that best? I don't think so. If the person truly is repentant, boy, it's much better together than apart, especially if there's children. Financially, it's a disaster. Just wisdom would tell you. Plus, if you're a Christian and you've been violated by your partner being in adultery, what's the Hosea principle? What would God do? He forgave her. And he took her back and he had her. So I think the question is, can you get a divorce? I probably would not discipline someone out of our church for getting a divorce if someone had adultery. But I think the better, if the person who committed it was repentant, I would strongly encourage them to forgive and move on. So, that's a good question. How do you deal with growth and evangelism in a church where growth and evangelism in the local context would mean bringing in a diverse, let's just say what we're all saying, socioeconomic context, racial context, sometimes language context. So what should you, how should you balance that? Is that fair summary? Okay. Well, we do struggle with that at Grace Church. And we have, I don't know what you call it here, but can I just speak openly? And if I offend someone, it's not my intent. I just want to be honest about it. We have what we call white flight in the States. Grace Community Church has been suspect to this in some degree as well. It's built on Roscoe Boulevard. It was there. It's been there for 40 plus years. And originally, it was just a normal kind of, actually, it was a relatively Jewish, but pretty much middle-class white neighborhood. Now, 40 years later, it's there's a lot of Thai. Sean, you've been by there. We have a Buddhist temple just down the road from us. We're actually, our church is on Thai holy ground. So it's a mile radius from that church, so that temple. So it's like kind of special. But there's a lot of Thai. There's still a Jewish contingency. Enormous Hispanic population. It's much more depressed socioeconomically than it was a long time ago. And a lot of the people just moved out of that valley. Right or wrong, they did. But they still come to grace because that's where grace is. What we've tried to do to remedy that, and then I'll expand that a little bit more on your question, is we've recognized that, and I hope we've repented. We're not going to tell the people who live, 25 minutes away who drive in, don't come to our church because it's not local. But we are trying to have outreaches into our community and make it serious. We have a Thai outreach. We have a Jewish outreach, which is very offensive to them, by the way. We have a synagogue just five doors down from us. And when we go door to door and do evangelism, they're very offended that we would do that. So we're trying to reach our community. One of the things that makes it a challenge for us is that the majority of the people around Grace Church now speak Spanish, not English. So we have a Spanish service. We have a whole Spanish ministry. We have a Spanish pastor who's now, Henry Tolopilo, he's gotten literally world renowned because he takes MacArthur sermons, adds a little bit of his stuff, and he is now the Juan MacArthur of, he's in Brazil, he's in a lot of places. South America, so we're Spanish is spoken. I know it's Portuguese in Brazil, but there is a section of it that's Spanish speaking that he goes to and ministers. So we've tried to do that. Now that's just our effort. What should you do? I think that we should stop listening to the sociologists who tell us that blacks and white, you need to have black churches, white churches, Filipino churches, Korean churches. I mean that when we only have racially segregated churches, it's a reflection of spiritual immaturity. It's not wrong, like you're going to go to hell, but it's a reflection of spiritual immaturity. And I think the more mature the church, the more racially diverse it should and could and will become, because you begin to hold tight that which is really in common, which is the gospel and truth. Now, what you're asking is very interesting, too. You're saying, well, what about if the culture is different? Then we should enjoy one another, love one another, defer to one another, and just kind of move on as best we can, but to find what's common and to build on the common and not emphasize or accent what's distinctive and enjoy the distinctives. I just think that sometimes, especially in South Africa, which is the most complicated place on the planet, thank you very much, I used to think it was black and white. No, it's not black and white. It's black and it's Costa Zulu colored, everything. It's British, it's Afrikaans, it's Dutch. I'm like, you guys, this is the most complicated place I've ever been in my life. Just love each other. but I think that maturity and the love of Christ and the fellowship of the gospel can transcend that. But it takes enormous effort, enormous sacrifice, and great pain. And I have found, if I can speak very directly, that the younger generation is more willing to do that than the older. So, did that kind of address your question? The gospel is precious. We're going to worship with each other, no matter what color we are, throughout all eternity. We should start, there's practicing for heaven. Every tribe and tongue around the throne then, we ought to have every tribe and tongue around the pulpit now. So, what's that? Heavenly culture. We should bring heaven to earth. So, yes, sir.
Could you explain to us how you balance your life between your away from the family? Just give us a little bit of insight.
How can I balance my life? No. Next question. that's difficult. I was talking to my friends Ryan and Bronwyn about this just the other day. It's easy for me to tell you how good I do when I'm on the other side of the planet. I would much prefer to do that with my wife sitting in here so she could, tell me, when I'm being too, when I'm exaggerating. I'll try to be as honest as possible. Number one, I don't do a very good job. My life is very, very complicated. Not that you want to know, but you ask. I teach at the seminary in preaching. I teach in the college in youth ministry. I'm full-time at the church in my college ministry and youth ministry. I teach, I direct a doctoral program at the seminary. I sit on the senior staff at our church. I'm an elder. I'm on three boards, and I have a wife and three kids. And it's just ridiculous. So what Kim and I do, first of all, is we have business meetings, my wife and I. She and I, once a month on a Sunday afternoon, we get a babysitter, and we go down to a little coffee shop, and we plan our month. Sometimes we usually plan months out if major events are coming. We put all the major events on the calendar, birthdays, anniversaries, holidays, things we need to do. And then we plan, at least in the evenings, we plan our date nights, which is once at least every other week. I would like to tell you it's every week, but it's really about every other week. And our family nights, which is at least three nights a week and usually four. And by family night, I mean that I come home at 5 o'clock and I don't answer the phone and I don't go. I'm there for my boys and my wife. Now, we have our phone messaging machine allows us to hear who's calling. And if I need to take the call, I will. And if 9 times out of 10, they hear that and they hang up because they don't want to leave a message. And I say, it's your loss, you know. So we screen our calls significantly. I have a cell phone that I use profusely. I'm not going to tell you how many hours on my cell phone, because every time I'm in the car, I can use that as counseling time, as direction time. But we plan all of our nights. Therefore, if you and your wife said, hey, Rick, can we get together with you next week, next Thursday night? I look and I say, you know what, I'm so sorry, I can't do that, I have a commitment. And the commitment may be, I'm going to come home and do nothing but be with my sons and my wife. So we plan our times out. I'm doing macro, and I'll get more specific in a second. If I offend you or someone else because you can't get to me quickly, you'll get over it. If I neglect my boys and my wife, I've lost everything. And they're far too precious to do that. So on a personal level, I try to give my mornings to God, my afternoons to people, and my evenings to my family. My mornings are study and reading. Because I'm freshest in the morning. I'm a weird duck, and I understand this. I go to bed at 8:30 and get up at 4, sometimes 3:30. And I get a couple hours in the morning of reading time, go in the office to do that, try not to check my email till after lunch. And so that's my time with God. In my afternoons, I'll meet with people, teach classes, do counseling, do administration at the seminary, various committee meetings or board meetings. The one exception to that is Monday. We have our pastoral staff meeting Monday morning. Afternoons, people, and nights are my families, unless we have to do something. Now, fellowshipping with other people, I mean, I'm not a family-olator. I mean, if you and your wife and your kids come over and we have fellowship together, that's family time too. So we're not so strict that we do nothing. Sunday nights, Kim and I meet with couples for premarital discipleship. And Tuesday mornings I meet with my shepherds. It's about 30 guys who are leaders in our ministry. And Thursday morning at 6, I meet with my interns. And so I've over-answered your question. Oh, no, no. I really sounded good what I just said. But that I struggle. I don't know if it's pretty balanced. One thing that Kim and I do, for example, the week before I came to South Africa, we did nothing. I came home at 3 o'clock every day and spent time with them. The week when I get back, I'm doing nothing in the evenings. You know, I mean, I'm going to be away for 2.5 weeks. So sometimes people have crises. They need to talk, and counseling things come up. Yeah. So you just balance things as you go along, and you cancel things. I have no problem at all canceling something if I need to take care of my wife and family. They are my priority. So anyway, thank you. My prayer life is not nearly what I want it to be. It's better than it used to be, but it's not as good as I want it to be. I figured out something about me and my personality. Everyone works differently. Some people pray in the car or in the shower. In the shower, I'm thinking about my day. In the car, I'm using the phone. It's just crazy. But I figured out that if I make an appointment with you at Thursday at 11 o'clock, I'm going to be ready Thursday at 11, and we're going to do that. So I literally, in my calendar, which my secretary through the computer is hooked up to, I schedule prayer. I have an appointment with God, on Monday at 1 o'clock, well, it's 2:30 really, Monday at 2:30 for a half an hour or so, and that's just during the office. Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday mornings, because of my schedule, it's usually 8 to 9, 8 to about 8:45. Wednesday is a really flexible day, so I don't always get to schedule things. I just make an appointment with God. I know it sounds cheesy, but that's the only way it works with me. Because my life is, I look at my palm pile, I look at my computer, I look at my schedule, I finish something, what's next? Okay, I finish something, what's next? I have two things, what my appointments and my tasks. And I just, when I have appointments, I meet with them. When I stop an appointment, I go to my task list, and I keep working through my task list until I get time for another appointment. I go to my appointment, boom. It's just the only way I can control my life. I make my tasks out every morning, and I prioritize them. A, what has to happen today. B, what could happen today. C, if I don't get to it today, it's okay. There's all the A's, the B's, the C's. Now all the A's. What's number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8? And the B's. If I get to the B's, what's the first thing I should do, the second thing? And then whenever I'm not in an appointment, I'm on my task list doing those things. And it's not that brilliant, but you'd be surprised how much you can get done if you'll just organize your life into those simple things. But prayer life, I have to make an appointment with God. And I also pray in the mornings when I get up. I get up very early, usually about 2:30 or 3 on Sunday morning, and pray and go over my notes for Sunday. And that's, I feel a little silly saying this. That's because I love to preach. And when I get up on Sunday mornings to preach, it's like Christmas. And I can't sleep. I'm so excited that in a few hours, I'm going to get to stand in front of my people and open the Bible and say, this is what God says. I just love that. So, and it's not because I think I'm a good preacher. It's because I just love to, preach. I love to be in the Word. I love to hear God's directing of my thoughts. And I learn a lot from myself in preaching, and it's not because I'm good. I think when you study all week, you get your notes together, you get in the pulpit, and you begin preaching, God uses all that, and He puts it together in a way that you say some things, and you think, oh, that made a lot of sense. But I'm smart enough to know it wasn't me. That was God doing something in the illuminating power and the enlightening power of the moment of preaching this. I'm not a mystical, but there's something going on there in the preaching moment. Those of you who are preaching know what I mean, that you just can't describe. And I just, it's a time with God. So I just like that. Sean.
You mentioned you improve after counseling. Do you use certain tools? Do you have analysis, personality analysis? How do you get into it? Give us some principles of how you do premarital counseling.
How do we do premarital counseling? We use Wayne Mack's book, Preparing for Marriage. I know they've had that here in the past when he was down here. It's a workbook that we have each of the couples go through, each person, the guy and the gal go through, and we talk through those things. But we basically go through, I hope I can remember right now, 6 C's. This is how you evaluate your relationship, and here's how you grow. Christ, is He central? Is the gospel central? It's in my bag. I hope I can remember them all. I'm not sure if these are in order. Christ. Communication. How do you communicate? Do you do a good job? Do you do a bad job? And that follows closely on the heels with conflict. How do you resolve conflict? Because how you resolve conflict before you get married will tell me what I need to know afterwards. So Christ, communication, conflict, cash. Let's talk about money. What's your principles? What's your values? What are you doing with those? Did I just get 4 of them? Well, children is under Christ, and I'll tell you why in a minute. I do this all the time, you can tell. Communication, we already did. What is that? It starts with a C, so we could probably figure it out. Care. Do you actually... I know you love this person, but do you like them? It's a lot easier to love someone than it is to like them. Which, interestingly enough, by the way, do you know Titus 2, when it tells young women, old women to teach younger women to love their husbands, the word there is like. It's not love. Husbands are told to agapeo their wives, to love them, in Ephesians 5. Nowhere in the Bible does it tell wives to love their husbands. Why? Because I think God just assumes that. But it's hard to like us. So, there's another C, and I'll get it for you later. I'm sorry. Children is under Christ because a Christ-centered home includes, we have some sub-points, includes Christ-centered worship, Christ-centered relationships, and Christ-centered parenting. So that, I want to make sure that parenting is underneath Christ, not its own thing, or you can become worshiping the family outside of promoting the gospel in your family, which is the purpose of parenting. So,
and in line with that, how long do you counsel? What sort of limit?
It's good. It depends on the couple. I can't counsel all the couples in our ministry. But if they're close in leadership and I have a relationship with them, Kim and I will do that. What we usually do is meet with them every other week so we can get other couples in there, sometimes every third week, for anywhere from 2 to 4 months, depending on them. We give them homework assignments. We come back and talk through those things with them. Other couples that I'm going to marry, but someone else is doing their premarital counseling, I'll meet with twice, once in the beginning and once close to the wedding, and I interact with their premarital couple because we have a whole ministry of doing that at Grace and kind of figure out what was going on. So, depends. I can't get to everyone who's in our ministry who wants to do that, but usually I wish it was every week for a few months, but because of the numbers, I can only do every other or every third week. So we typically don't have more than 3 couples we're dealing with in any 2 or 3 month block. Premarital counseling is a prerequisite to get married at Grace Church or by a Grace Church pastor. I would never do it with someone who hadn't been premarital counseled from our church, unless I was flying somewhere to do it, like I did my brother's wedding. So, some exceptions. I could ask you questions. It's so complicated with us. They have sports. They have, they're in plays. They're in dramas. They got this after school thing. They got this program. They're in this honor deal. It's incredible. And you say, where's God in all that? Usually the place to deal with those values is not with the student, but with the parent. If you're going to get into an issue with some kids about their commitments, make sure you've had a prior discussion with their parents, because sometimes, I remember, case in point, I remember telling a guy several years ago who wanted to pursue the Lord and do ministry, but was on a college basketball team, university basketball team, that he needed to, I said, if you want to do that, you can't do both. You need to make a choice. And he told his dad that, and his dad just went ballistic. No, this is an important part of your development. You will play that. Well, now we have a conflict. So I've learned the hard way to talk through those issues with the parents before I even do that. And another, one of the other components is that they will be, I'm hesitating because I know what this is going to sound like. I'll just say it and then edit it. If our discipleship and in our ministry, I think, was more attractive and better and more God-centered, they would be making those decisions a lot more easily. That's not indicting you. It's me included. If we're really doing it right, then the right people would be attracted and the wrong people wouldn't want to be. So sometimes the problem is as much ours. Is the problem the chef or the guy at the table? Well, it depends. It depends on his taste, and it depends on whether the chef has done something, stupid or not. So I think we need to look at ourselves and say, is this really attractive? If I had them quit their 5 activities and meet with me at the tea house or the coffee shop every Thursday or every Saturday or whenever, would they be getting something worth quitting those other things for? It's hard. Deal with the parents on that, or you are inviting a world of hurt. Beyond that, it would be an individual. I think I would answer the question differently with each individual student. Yes, sir.
Have they been challenged to debate?
Question is, what about Christian debating, whether it's defending, a war or a doctrinal issue, and what about that in general? And have we received any requests to do that or approached any people to do that? I have the gift of questions. I can summarize others' questions. I just can't answer them. Yes, I think there's biblical precedence for the debates. First of all, you find in the the Jerusalem Council a debate over what was really salvation. Were they to include the Old Testament law with New Testament salvation? So you see very early there was a format for debating the theological issues. The church councils were all good because they defined where the church stood. I praise God for the Catholic councils, because what they did is they recorded what they really believed. And the Protestant, Trent and I'm thinking of the Westminster divines who came out with the catechism. They debated that for months before they wrote that down. So I think there is precedent for that. Biblically, Peter told them, be ready to give an account for the hope that's within you. So we need to have, we need to know our stuff. Now, have we done that? We have we've done that a few times, but not a lot. And I just think it's just pragmatic. John MacArthur's life in Grace Church is so consumed with what we're doing. It's not like we have time to go, you know, pick debates with other people. There's just no time for it. John has been invited to other places. He went to, he debated R.C. Sproul on infant baptism one time. And you talked to Joel about maybe getting those tapes. R.C. Sproul would tell you that John dusted him in that debate. John said, I'll debate you. And it was at a Ligonier conference with several thousand people there. And MacArthur went, then R.C. Sprint, then there was a Q&A between them. They're the best of friends, by the way, too. Really dear friends. But John said, I'll do it as long as I can go first. And John's parting comment was, R.C., you say you believe in the Bible. You say you believe all the Bible and only the Bible. Infant baptism isn't in the Bible. I can't wait to hear what you say. And that was, it was just, it was a lot of fun. He's done that before. I've done debates. I've did debate on USC and UCLA, as Cal State, Northridge. So I'll do that on the college campuses. You know, we put out flyers. I think I told some of you guys this. Everything's mixing together now on who killed Jesus, and had an open debate. Whoever wants to talk about that, and we got a chance to do that. So we have done that, and I think there's biblical precedence. That's the short version of it. I'm not going to step into your trap.
Last year, Joel, he held a session on that. But then he asked, but then after, and then someone asked him, so does he believe in the double? That some, because choose some to go to heaven, some to hell. But if you believe that God chooses some to go to heaven, what about the rest?
Yeah, the question is, what about double predestination? If you believe that God chose some, does that infer that he neglected others? Logically, yes. Absolutely. I mean, you have to say that. And it doesn't surprise me, and I'm not alarmed at God choosing some for damnation. I'm surprised he didn't choose me for damnation. So, logically, yes. I still believe that he's a savior for all men, especially those who believe that in Timothy, that and Peter, he is not willing that any should perish, but all should come to repentance. I believe that there's a call. Whoever comes to me, I will not cast out. I believe those texts, but I also believe that no one will come unless God chooses them. So, logically, it doesn't work, and his ways aren't our ways. And I would just admit that I am at a quandary. Man goes to hell, though, not because God didn't choose him. Nowhere does the Bible say that. He goes to hell because he rejected the gospel and didn't believe and repent. Man goes to heaven because God chose him to give grace to him in his sovereign grace, and I affirm that doctrine absolutely, unequivocally, unashamedly. And I understand the logic is that that means he predetermined some to go to hell. Frankly, I don't have any problem with that because we all should have gone to hell. So it's usually an emotional argument more than anything else. I don't believe in outright double predestination as it is framed by the Arminian movement. I believe man has responsibility, and the Bible says that he goes to hell because of his choice. But I also believe that he goes to heaven only by God's choice. And I can't say it any more clear than that. You can press me the rest of the afternoon, and I won't get any clearer than that. It is a divine mystery that I can't solve. And I'm okay with that. Was Jesus God or man? Yes. Okay. Do you work out your salvation, or does God? Both. Philippians 2. Work out your salvation in fear and trembling, for it is God who's at work within you. You know, there's a lot of tensions in the Bible. I just can't. You know, the same sun that melts the wax hardens the clay. So I don't understand that mystery. But I have just wrecked my brain so much trying to figure it out. I give up. I believe. and I'll sort it out. C.S. Lewis had an interesting thing in Mere Christianity. He says the first two words out of every Christian's mouth when they get to heaven will be, "Of course." It will all make sense then. And I appreciate the question. I've wrestled with the question. I believe the tenets underline the question, and I don't know. So, is that fair?